Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. The sculpture exhibition by the De La Torre brothers has just been extended by the National Hispanic Cultural Center until August 16th, and with good reason. It'll blow you away as it did me. And to talk about their work, I'm joined here in the studio by Arnar and Hamex De La Torre. Welcome to the program, you guys.
Thank you, Stephen. Hola, everybody.
Hello.
What I'd like to do is start with the evolution of your work to the point that it's now arrived at, with these references to pre-Columbian work, Catholic imagery, incredible amounts of color, decoration, just brimming with all sorts of ideas. How and why did you get to this point? How did your work evolve to this point?
I think to explain that evolution better, we have to tell you a little bit about our personal biographies. We came to the United States. I was 12 years old. My brother was 8 years old. We went pretty much from conservative Catholic schools in Guadalajara, Mexico, to a beach town in Southern California, Dana Point, from a Catholic schools to surfer high schools. So it was a big change for us. And from then on, we always...
Like opposite ends of a continuum?
Yeah. In some sense, there was continuum, I guess. But it really blew our minds for a while.
It was culture shock included.
Yes.
Definitely. And we attended Long Beach State University, where my brother, who, of course, went there before I did, graduated from high school 3 years before I did, which is our age difference. He chose that school because it was very classical sculpture department, so he was really gravitated to live figure drawing and sculpting and so on. And it had a glass-blowing facility at the time. So by the time I arrived, he was already blowing glass, and I fell right into that. I was doing ceramic and glass sculpture, and that really clicked with us, the immediacy of the material, the fact that it's out the next day and it's shiny. It's for two people that grew up with cartoons, and Catholic art, it really sort of was very gratifying to be able to churn something out so quickly.
And how did you get to this current point of this obvious interest in pre-Columbian, which is a fancy word for American art prior to the Columbus coming here, pre-Columbian art and this Catholic imagery?
In describing our biography, we want to express the idea that we see things in layerings. We're Mexicans. We're also Americans. We live in the border. And there's all these influences that come to play in our work. So by the time we got to study art in college, we saw the complete opposite, which was a minimalist aesthetic going around. Everybody wanted to distill an idea in art to the minimal.
When was this?
Early 80s. Uh-huh. And our tendency has always been to add more layering, because that's how our life as an immigrant and repatriated Mexicans feels like. We're binationals, bicultural. We feel comfortable on both sides, so we add layer upon layer. And that's how our work developed. We eventually came to mixed media, because different mediums give you different qualities, and the different concepts are also weaved into the pieces.
And could I ask you to give your website in case people have access to a computer and would like to look at some samples of your work?
Yes, that would be delatorrebros.com, DelatorreBros.com. It's not quite up to date, but there's a lot of imagery you can see on there. And I think what is up to date is the calendar section on it, where we do some teaching. We generally do classes in blown glass and mixed media, places like Pilchuck School of Glass north of Seattle. Next week we're going to be going to Penland School of Crafts in North Carolina.
Yeah, these are some very famous places.
Yeah, these are some schools that have a lot of history, especially Penland is really, really, 100-year-old history. We will also be teaching later this year in Oaxaca, in a hot shop there, in a glass shop, doing sculpture and glass for a week down there near the Day of the Dead. So it'll be fun.
Now, one of the things you mentioned it was your personal history. And I understand from talking to you prior to the show that you had a Danish grandfather. And in your view, that makes you mestiza. And I wanted just to call your attention to your work Mestiza Defined, because it seems there seems to be a direct relationship between, you know, your personal history and this artwork.
Yeah, it's Mestizaje Defined is a piece that
Forgive my Spanish.
Oh, no worries. It's a piece that has these faces are from Veracruz. They're very inspired by the Veracruz Laughing Boys pre-Columbian work. And they have their resin casts with beans, composed of beans inside, and they have different beans, and we're sort of relating the different colors of the beans to the different casts that they had for the mixture of races that the Spanish had for, whether it's a mixture of a mulatto with an Indian and so on. They had very derogatory names for these
things. Yeah, and the very, very explicit caste system.
Yes, pretty rough stuff now to look at in terms of the implied racism. It's pretty strong stuff. I mean, to try to glorify the conquest is pretty tough, I think, when you actually analyze what happened. So this piece is dealing with that it's the same face, but there's different compositions, just like we may have a quarter Dane in us. But, you know, it's like a lot of Americans. They're mostly Euro-Mutts, and so we're probably, you know, also largely Euro-Mutt too. It's just different quantities of different things.
Now, one of the pieces in the exhibition that really struck me is a piece called Crossing the Border. Now this piece isn't like probably the Crossing the Border that you do. Maybe you could describe the piece for me.
Yes, Crossing the Desert.
Crossing the Desert, sorry.
Yeah, that piece is it's a cactus with a crucified figure on it, and it says Taco Time on his forehead. So he's basically one of the undocumented workers coming to work. When the Operation Gatekeeper started in San Diego, they made it harder to cross the border near Tijuana, so they pushed people out into the mountains and then down to the desert, the Sonoran Desert, a very harsh environment, and people are, of course, perishing from a lack of water trying to cross the border. It's pretty terrible stuff. So Crossing the Desert has a double meaning, because there are also all these crosses on the desert from people who have perished along the way.
And Crossing the Desert also conjures a trip of transformation when you expose yourself out there to the elements, and you sort of like Carlos Castañeda's books, right? You go into the desert to look for yourself. And it also has that idea, and I think that's a good example, because it does have those layers that don't linearly relate to each other, and most of our work is like that.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm talking to the De La Torre brothers here about their work. It's at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, extended until August 16th. If you want to see what their work looks like, just Google De La Torre Bros. Now, one of the things about the crossing the desert is it seems to be both blown glass and cast glass. And I wonder about... And the colors are so vivid. I'm wondering about these aesthetic judgments. I mean, do you think visually, and is it really the aesthetic judgment that comes to you, or the aesthetic idea that comes to you, or do you think more politically and culturally, and then do the piece?
It's a combination of things, but I think the use of color, I think I would directly go to the vernacular. The sort of use of color that you will see in the street in Mexico is something we've always gravitated to. I think that it's pretty well recognized that the Mexican aesthetic is not afraid of color. And I think when you're not afraid of it, you use it very differently than if you're worried about colors going together or not. You're sort of using your intuition or your gut sense. So colors, I think, come out of that realm. As far as the content being political, yeah, we're very driven, I think, by idea. But we're also really interested in process, driving the ideas.
I'd like to add that the colors also come from being members of a modern society with a tremendous consumer culture that assaults you at every place. And also as kids, having grown up with cartoons in Mexico and in the United States, those are also layers that come into just the realm of color.
So how would that impact crossing the desert, Amex?
That impacts actually this talk about the color. I think almost all the pieces.
I mean the color. I mean one of the things it's the contrast. This as you say, the figure looks so brownish red and so dehydrated.
Yeah, cooked.
And he's so vivid on the green Sahara cactus. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so striking.
But, you know, to add to what my brother was saying about the commercial thing, with a little title he has on his forehead that's Taco Time, mm-hmm. that's a chain of Mexican food establishments in the Pacific Northwest. So it is an advertisement for them. I guess he was going to go work for them, or if you will. So mm-hmm. there's a little bit of an element that from far away, that cactus could be just outside of that food establishment trying to invite you to come have really bad version of Mexican food.
And there he is dying in the desert.
Yeah, the sacrifice has been made, which, of course, another sacrifice, if you will, is the fact that we are allowing people to work here on a subhuman standards in order to keep our prices low as consumers.
And you see that in the figure. He's been dehumanized.
Absolutely. And, of course, by crucifying him, it brings the idea of the sacrifice more and more to the point. And sometimes we do spell things out rather obviously.
Yeah, we start with the tongue-in-cheek humor in Taco Time, but I think we end up with ironic humor. In the end, we're expressing that we think that, yeah, you're eating the cheap labor, so you're eating the flesh of the crucified worker in your Taco Time taco.
Now, one of the things about your work, I mean, it's so beautiful and it's so multi-layered. It's multi-layered literally. There's all these different layers in it. It's multi-layered mentally, because as you look at it, you glean more and more about what you're talking about.
But it's very important for us to have a clean and neat statement and design. It has to make sense to us, both in terms of concept and visually. It's not just we're very much Baroque artists. We like to put as much as possible, and we don't really like empty spaces. They don't. But at the same time, we want the eye to travel comfortably through the piece, for the whole piece to make sense at some level to us.
And if I may add, the idea with the glass, it's such eye candy, it's so appealing, it's so shiny and colorful that for us, we really love the sucker punch that you can have when there's maybe a funny idea or a funny title, and then bring them in because it's alluring and there's this big jewel-like thing. And then upon closer inspection, there's actually some content that may be a little stronger. So if it's a way to actually get somebody to stop and look at the piece and consider it, then in our day and age of sound bites, you've already kind of won the battle when people just thought about what some of the ideas.
You know, one of the things that strikes me in your answers, you're constantly talking about us and what we do. And obviously, you collaborate in this work. Now, I guess to some extent, blowing glass is almost necessarily collaborative, right? Because there's one, you know, like when I looked on the web, there's one guy blowing and one guy turning the pipe. But I mean, but you don't necessarily, you could do this work with other people. You've chosen to collaborate with each other, and why is that?
Like you said, blowing glass is yes, necessarily a collaborative process, and I think that's one of the things that attract us the most about the process, because it's you feed from the people who are helping you and from each other, and on top of that, it's tremendously spontaneous. You are producing something with fire in a pretty rapid rate. It comes out of the fire rather rapidly.
And we love the energy of having to fix the airplane while it's in flight.
No, one of the things you're not is this loner, sort of misunderstood artist, kind of, you know, making art about yourself. That's sounds true. Like what you're really doing is making art about different. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that that is the mythology of art education, of what an art biography should be, the lone, suffering, misunderstood artist. And part of what we're saying with our collaboration is that nobody is really that alone. You come with a huge baggage of influences, and you're probably going to get a lot of help. And if you really read our biographies out there, there were a lot of people helping all these lone artists. It might be their spouses who were supporting them all through, you know.
And who doesn't like to have their supporting mother, you know? Because for us, her mother was a great influence and huge support. But yeah, I think we believe that's overrated. And not only the idea of the loner is overrated, but you are, since you are a bunch of influences, it's a lot more humbling to understand that even though the way that you reshuffle the cards may be unique, you are, after all, shuffling a set of experiences. and coming up with something new in only insofar as you're making new combinations of these things. It's also humble to know we're not here so long. So really, if you know, to have grandiose ideas of what you can do and how you can change the world is all very well and fine. But I think it's a lot better to realize that there is a lot of possibilities out there. And yes, you can bring something new, but you're not, you know, who's going to change humanity here?
One of the things I'm interested in is your view of contemporary art. I mean, your art's very accessible. And you know, I go to a lot of art exhibitions, and I like some and I don't like others of it. It's sort of hard to generalize, but you're right in the midst of it. What's your view on contemporary art?
I think modern art has been rather intimidating to the general public because it's become a kind of a highfalutin intellectual exercise. And we personally have found a lot of the modern art visually very boring. Now, having said that, I think...
Why is it visually boring to you?
Well, I talked earlier about how in the 80s there was a lot of tendency for conceptual minimalist art. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff, sometimes they didn't even use materials. It was just the concept of the art itself. And I think it ended up alienating most people. They go to the museums and they say, well, to us it's... people should go to a museum and appreciate art like they appreciate music. They can like it or not like it. They don't have to explain anybody why they didn't like it. They don't need to be assaulted by an intellectual exercise that makes them feel stupid. And I completely agree to that. Having said that, I think in the last few years, we have contemporary art scene has changed a lot. And at least to our personal taste, there's a lot of really exciting stuff out there that is very visually very challenging, yeah, not just intellectually.
Yeah, we believe visual art should even if it has a very, very complex case to make, should at least attempt to make most of its case visually. It's okay to have a supporting piece of paper on the wall that maybe clues you in on some stuff, because no, we're not all library. We don't all have an encyclopedic knowledge, and we don't know everything about everything. So being filled in is not bad, but we think that should be seen in terms of clues, so you can get clued in and then make your own judgments. And art that has a particular, what some contemporary art did for a while was very much about a particular outcome. And if you don't get that, you don't get it. And I think that's a pretty preachy place to come from. And we're not giving people. So in other words, art.
So how do you make your art so your art's very accessible? And do you think about that when you create pieces?
I think all artists think about how their work is going to be seen by as broadly as possible. I think that is part of their job. They shouldn't limit them to do what they need to do, but you do need to be you need to have all the considerations, because after all, you're not the public that's viewing it. The problem is when artists make work just for curators or just for collectors, and they forget about the possibility of having Joe Sixpack view the work. And I think it's important to listen to what Joe Sixpack has to say. Kids are wonderful art critics if you stop and listen to them. They shoot from the hip. And
yeah, I saw some kids loving your stuff when I was there, by the way.
Yeah, as long as they don't start climbing it, right?
Exactly. Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz, and we're talking about the sculptures of the De La Toya brothers, which you can Google and see examples of. And it's at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. It's there till August 16th. The center charges, I think, $3 for an adult during the week, and it's free on Sundays if you want to go. And one of the things I want to ask you about is, where does glasswork stand in the art world today? It seems to have had its periods. There was that robust period. There have been some robust periods, but I don't really know where glasswork stands at the moment.
The contemporary studio glass movement is really a pretty interesting story that started in the 60s with some pretty pioneering crafts artists that decided to build their own glass shops in their backyards, basically. And it evolved into something pretty incredible that kind of peaked in the 90s with the works of Chihuly, among other glass artists. But it was a pretty particular – it was an interesting movement because it had its own curators, galleries, and collectors. So it became kind of insulated from the general art, even the craft movements themselves. And by doing so, it became its own bubble. And the bubble kind of burst earlier, last decade, I think, we believe. And people were not making as much money as they used to. Mm-hmm.
But we really aren't good a good person to ask, because we've never really had a firm footing in the glass. We have had a firm footing in the glass world in terms of maybe a certain amount of acknowledgement or teaching with students and going to universities, but not so much with collectors. So we've never really had that much.
Your work is truly mixed.
It's pretty. Even the glassier pieces are still very much mixed media. And I don't know for right or wrong. We have accessed more a regular art market with them than the glass market. Yeah, that just happens to be.
I'd like to turn to another piece. Actually, a couple pieces. The Tula series again, because they're fascinating. It's a fascinating series. Why don't you describe a little bit of the Tula series?
Those are we've been working for a while on these pieces based on Toltec, sort of this totemic pieces that they have it's a ruin in Hidalgo, Mexico. Very emblematic. These are pieces.
These are the Mexican pyramids that are sort of right outside Mexico City that you can go see.
No, these are in Hidalgo. They're a little further north. Aztec. These are Toltec. But they are also like some of the Aztec jewels, Aztec calendar and other part. They're very emblematic pieces and very recognized. All that's left of them are these very tall columnar figures. They're sort of they probably were holding up a temple. Anyway, we've used these in several pieces, and these particular two that are in that you're referring to. Actually, we have four different Tulas in the show: 2 9-footers and 2 6-footers.
They're big,
and they're glass construction. We made the two taller ones at a residency in Kansas City at Grand Arts, and one of them has things from Kansas City inside of it, and the other one has things from Michoacán. So we made one of them sort of a north and south centuries, and we viewed them as centuries, thinking about the border in between and the border between the culture and so on.
Could you describe them just a little more specifically so a listener might understand what they look like?
Well, like Anna was saying, they're totemic, so they're actually columns supporting a bigger roof in the ruins. So for us, it was it became an easy way to produce sculptures. They're basically stacked boxes. They're glass boxes put together with silicone, sort of like aquariums, mm-hmm. on top of each other, making this kind of robot-like sculpture. And each box, you can features a sort of diorama inside that you can view from all angles. And in the middle part, where the real tulas are supposed to be holding this butterfly emblem, we put a television, sort of Teletubby-like television, in the middle of the chest. And each one of the tulas has a different video that we produced with poet friends of ours.
Yeah, and what it seems like one of the things you're very interested in is this historical work of Mexico, because it's not just the Toltec work. You're interested in the Aztec, the Mayan, the Olmec. And I mean, one of the things about the works that harken back to that is that they're beautiful. I mean, they're striking and they're beautiful, but I think you see more than that when you use them.
Well, we were drawn to the jewels of pre-Columbian Mexico more than anything, because as modern Mexicans, we were fed, spoon-fed those images as nationalist symbols in the coins, in the shirts of the national soccer team. They're everywhere. So that is our personal right to them. That is to say that we're actually developing their lives as souvenirs more than claiming a link to the ancient Mexico, which we can't really claim. We're modern Mexicans, and we're saying this is the souvenir for our times that we have to somehow make sense to ourselves.
And by having cliché images that are already cliché, they already have such a standing, such a status of overuse that in itself is a very interesting dialogue for us to peek into, and how images that are so overly used to represent an ancient culture become modern symbols in a different way, whether it's the government using it as a source of nationalistic pride, or it is tourism industry using them as come down and look at our ancient jewels. All of those image, all of those ideas are bring possible layers and meanings.
Yeah, I want to talk about one more example of your work, and that's Tijuana on a Silver Platter. And the thing about this work that struck me are the layered look of the colors. It's just beautiful. But there's much more there. So do you want to describe that piece for us?
It's literally a platter, a silver platter with a bunch of glass fruit and a shark in the middle with a Tijuana written on it.
It's a glass shark, too.
It's a glass shark. So yes. Visually, it looks like a party platter. But once you examine it closely, you'll see that you have a shark there that appears to still be alive. And there's weapons in the mix.
There's fruit, weapons, and candy. So for us, it's the bittersweet situation that Tijuana is. This sort of course, historically, people would go down there into prohibition and drink, prostitution, all these things that were not accessible in the U.S. People would go down there and use Tijuana for what they needed to use and then discard.
So is the shark image that? Is that?
Well, yeah, it's got the double-edged sword, you know. It's in this case, the shark is not a lawyer, I guess, but it is a little bit of the. It might bite you. Might eat the shark in fish tacos, or it might bite you. There's a double, you know, and we thrive on that ambiguity. You know, you can start picking through the fruit or the wrapped candy that's made out of glass, but there's a gun in there. There's also a spatter of that could be blood, could be the marmalade. Then and that kind of that we really really enjoy that kind of pulling you in with one and then sucker punching you.
And one of the things about now this work is just jammed full. It's brimming full of color and objects and layers. Like crossing the border is much more simple. You can look at and I'm wondering about your decision to create that aesthetic.
Well, I think that it's if you fill the canvas up every square inch, it's easier to hide stuff and to have things that are surprising you. And when you have something like crossing the desert, that the aesthetic is a lot more formal and there's a negative space, there's contrast. You can really there's very defined limits of one shape and another. Then there is the formalities. What's working for that in terms of the sculpture and the shape, and you know even seeing it from a distance. Whereas Tijuana on a Silver Platter, you really have to go up to it. Because it's so much stuff.
You've got to study it.
So much information. And distance, from a distance, it's just going to look like a, you know, it might as well have a cellophane wrapping on it. It looks like a party basket of some sort. So that you really need to get close to it. And I think it's important. You have to, as an artist, think about what the eye sees, what you are drawn to first, and how because, you know, you don't see it the same way that a person who's never seen it sees it. So you have to consider how somebody would go up and how their eye would travel across and how the information is read.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank my two guests, Einar and Jamex de la Torre. They have an exhibition of sculptures at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. That exhibition's been extended until August 16th. It blew me away when I saw it. I highly recommend it to all of you. I also want to thank my engineer today, Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this program is Tristan Klum. My name's Stephen Spitz, and you're listening to Community Powered Radio on KUNM.